Yeah, 136, State 6.
When police were called by people who saw his frenzied attack on his ex-girlfriend, he'd stabbed her 75 times and slashed her throat. His arrest was filmed by security cameras. In the words of the judge, Molly McLaren was 23, beautiful and intelligent. Her life full of promise ended by the young man she met on a dating app, whose response to their relationship breaking up was to plan her brutal murder. Sentencing him to life with a 26-year minimum, the judge said this was a cruel, calculated and cowardly act. This was an act of wickedness. You were determined to punish her for ending the relationship. You were seeking revenge.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today in the studio is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard analyst and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I am Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jay Clem is my colleague. And we are just wrapping up season 13 on the show, hoping for season 14. And I'm also very proud to say that I'm the casting director for a film that's premiering tonight called Akeda at the American Film Institute. It's a film that was extremely hard to cast. It's a film about ISIS propaganda movies that use real child soldiers, and they basically do snuff films on real soldiers. Anyway, but I'm very proud of this, and I hope it's going to get distribution soon. So there you go.
Sounds like an important subject to cover, and the fact you were the casting director on it, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
I'm
you.
Sure it's very powerful, but very disturbing.
Very, very.
So will people be able to see it? I mean, when will that decision be made?
Yeah, I'm not sure when these films get distro. I'm just glad it's going to have a screening tonight in Los Angeles at the American Film Institute. And, you know, we'll see where it goes from there. It's tough. It's a real tough one. So we'll see.
Well, congratulations. And we're going to be talking about another tough subject today. Mm-hmm. It was a case that actually we all felt strongly about. And a lot of our Facebook followers and people on Twitter reacted to a tweet that I put out regarding the case of Molly McLaren. And I certainly struggled with this case for many reasons. And one of the key reasons was on the day, June the 29th, when we were launching in London our first national best practice conference on stalking and the tools and risk assessments and our learning to prevent murder in slow motions, as I was stood on the platform in front of hundreds of police officers and domestic violence workers and probation officers, the news headlines rang out that a young girl, Molly McLaren, who was 23, had been stabbed to death in a car park outside a gym in Chatham, Kent. And as soon as I learned those facts, my mind started racing because I certainly started to wonder whether this was somebody that she knew, bearing in mind it was outside her gym, whether it was somebody who she had had a relationship with and whether it was somebody who was stalking her. Days later, it was confirmed that a young man had been arrested and that, yes, she had dated this individual and actually had dated him for 7 months. So I thought I'd just start with giving a background, an overview of the case so that those who aren't familiar with it understand it. And then Jim and Lisa will weigh in with questions and comments and thoughts. And the background is on June the 29th, Molly McLaren was stabbed more than 75 times in a car park outside her gym. She had split up with her ex, somebody called Joshua Stimson, 12 days earlier, but they had dated for less than 7 months, having met on Tinder. She had become scared of his behaviour in the relationship, and after they broke up, he started posting derogatory remarks and comments about her on Facebook and other social media and falsely claiming that she'd been taking cocaine. He was and became even more obsessed with her and possessive and jealous. And Molly actually told a friend, "I'm actually scared of what he might do. I'm scared that he might hurt me. I don't know how on the edge he is." And so on June the 29th, Molly was working out at her gym in Chatham, Kent. He appears in the same room that she's working out on. And I've actually viewed this piece of video footage. And she goes to talk with him and starts asking him why he's following her. And she starts to feel very uncomfortable and texts her mum saying, "Mum, he's turned up at the gym And he's now standing next to me, and her mum says, you know, come home immediately. And as she's leaving the gym, she texts a friend saying, I feel like I'm looking over my shoulder all the time. Molly leaves the gym. Minutes later, Stimpson is actually stood outside waiting for her by her car. And he then stabs her more than 75 times repeatedly with a kitchen knife. Police arrive and he's covered in blood and they arrest him. And a number of people who were passing by, somebody called Benjamin Morton, tried to save her. You know, very brave intervention, but unfortunately she died at the scene. Now, what came to light thereafter was that she had reported him to police a number of times with her mother. And the last time was on June the 27th. And in fact, a police officer called him up whilst with Molly and her mum and warned him not to behave like this again. It's actually hours after that call that he buys a knife from Asda, which is a local supermarket, and he also buys a pickaxe. On June the 28th, she posts that she's going to a pub on social media, the Ship and Trades, and he actually turns up at that pub and she says that she's scared and calls her mum, and her mum again tells her to go home. I'm just making an observation at this point that each time these things are happening, she is having to change her behaviour and he is the one that's unsanctioned. And that's something that I know people have reacted to. He was recently sentenced at court and he did plead diminished responsibility. So he put them all through a trial. And in fact, that was rejected by the jury and he was sentenced to 26 years. But anyone who's seen the media reports on this, and certainly the things that I posted on social media, will see that the reaction from the family was that they felt that much more needs to be done to raise the awareness of the dangers and risks of stalking, and also that they are the ones with the life sentence, not him. And they gave a very emotional statement outside of court. And it's certainly something for me that's all too familiar, that a young girl or woman goes to the police to report something that's happening to them, obsessive behaviour, and sanctions and appropriate action is not being taken. So I know, Lisa, you had some questions from some of our Facebook followers.
Yeah, I mean, I reposted the footage. There's chilling footage showing Molly in the gym and her stalker coming into the gym, and this is just a few minutes before he kills her. There's also footage of him going up and down the stairs, I guess getting up the nerve to go in. And our listeners had a huge response to that because so many of them have similar experiences of people stalking them and going to the police just like she did and nothing getting done. And got a ton of questions about how the police handled this and did they know how far they could go and could they have stopped him. So one thing that happened is that she goes to the police and they call him on the phone with her there and tell him, stay away from her. Is that the right thing to do, the wrong thing to do? Did it enrage him? What is your opinion about that?
Well, the first thing is that, you know, we always have to look at cases and the whole context of it. So, you know, understanding that these are patterned crimes is the most important part when somebody reports. So you would expect the officer or officers to look at the history and to get a very good understanding of, you know, whether this is someone who is known and on the intelligence database, whether he's been reported before. And they should also be asking the risk questions. So the dash in this case, but also the S dash, which are the 12 questions for if you're being stalked, that should be asked as a routine measure. Now, this particular case, there is an Independent Police Complaints Commission investigation that is currently being undertaken. And in fact, in many of the cases I talk about, that body is called in when it looks to be, you know, there's a previous history and the police haven't taken appropriate action. So I'm not going to talk specifically about the detail other than to say that having written the best practice, the things that I would expect are a victim being believed, a victim being taken seriously, the history being looked at, his and hers, on the crime reporting system and the intelligence logs, and questions being asked of her in terms of risk. So the 12 questions, and people can see those questions actually on the Dash website, and there's a particular section on what if you are a victim being stalked. And so I'll quickly just run through the questions. It's, you know, whether someone's very frightened. And of course, we know that Molly was. In fact, he had been writing too on social media, there's more to come. And she was expressing the fact that she was fearful. Two, is there a previous history of domestic abuse or stalking and harassment? Now, that could be to you as the primary victim reporting now. That could be previous history that this is somebody who's done it before. And yes, we know there were multiple other women who had reported that he had terrified them and terrorised them. Have they vandalised or destroyed your property? Now, that's a question that we know that if people damage property or the things that victims care about the most, the chances are they could then damage them or hurt them. Whether they've turned up more than three times a week unannounced. And of course, Molly was claiming that, yes, he was appearing at the gym and also at the pub and various places that she was. Whether they followed or loitered near your home or your workplace. So again, this is really trying to understand how much time and commitment and effort somebody's putting into the stalking. Whether they've made a threat of physical and or sexual violence. Now, we know that one in two of the domestic abuse stalkers, if they make a threat, they will act on it. One in two, 50%, half. Now, this is one of the most concerning high-risk factors in this checklist, and yet it is something that is still not being asked of victims. Also, whether they've acted violently towards somebody else during the stalking incident, whether they've engaged other people to help with their activities, whether they have a problem with drugs, alcohol, or mental health, whether there's a question that we've added in more recently, that which was launched at our conference, which is whether they have suicidality, whether there's a revenge motive, last resort thinking. And the 12th question is whether they've been in trouble with the police or whether there's a criminal history. Now, that criminal history could be intelligence. It doesn't necessarily mean to say it's a conviction. So these questions are there for a very specific reason. It's there because it helps us understand the risk that somebody poses to another, but it also tells a police officer where to collect the evidence, who else to speak to, who to get statements from. So actually, they're a very clever set of questions that were created by Drs. Lorraine Sheridan and Carl Roberts, and my role was operationalising them. Now, these are the sorts of things that, you know, as best practice, I would expect police forces to use. And in fact, the IPCC will be looking to see whether practice was followed.
With the Kent Police, yes.
Right. But what you don't see in there is a recommendation that they call the offender. In our experience in the behavioral analysis unit, we find that a potential offender who is obsessed with, possessive, and jealous of somebody they've had a short or even a long-term relationship with, that when it gets to obsession, when people start stalking, that any contact, positive or negative, by the victim or any representative thereof, will be seen by the offender as encouragement to prove how much that person, especially with erotomatic stalkers, to prove how much that person actually loves the victim and wants to be with the victim. And it helps the offender rationalize in their own mind that what he really needs to do is prove to that victim that they want him and they should be in his life. And so typically those kinds of interactions are not positive. They actually encourage worse offending behavior.
In this particular case, it was hours later that he then went and bought the knives and the pickaxe, which again showed that action, as we always know, will have a consequence.
Yes.
Now, it might be something that acts as a deterrent, but with stalkers, that is very rarely the case. And if there are two behaviours or more, it's an arrestable offence. It's called stalking. There's a stalking offence, which myself and many families of victims who had been murdered, like Claire Burnell's mother, Tricia, had campaigned for, to make sure that the next Claire Burnell, i.e. the next Molly, has a different response.
Right. And the thing is that what would have been appropriate for that police officer is to ask the questions, do the research, and then arrest the guy for causing fear in this victim. Why does Molly have to live one more day under that fear? And
right.
Why does she have to be exposed to being brutally murdered? It's outrageous. They have a law. I mean, we don't even have that law in the U.S. You guys in the U.K. are far ahead of us thanks to your efforts, Laura. But the fact is that even given the fact that you have the law, they're not exercising it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the big problems. I mean, we've just had Her Majesty's inspection for police forces and also for the Crown Prosecution Service. And that's exactly what they found. And that report was launched just weeks after our first conference. And we knew that the findings were pitiful through Paladin's work. You know, over 2,000 victims that we supported, and yet victims are not being taken seriously. They're not being believed when they report. We also know that 77% of them suffer 100 times before they report to the police. They report to the police. So the fact, whatever Molly was saying was just tip of the iceberg, but he was following her on nights out. He was posting things. He was going to the gym. You know, he was micromanaging her, and she felt terrified. And it takes a lot for someone to go to the police to report this type of crime.
Yeah, was this before she broke up with him, and this is why she broke up with him?
So they broke up, I believe, a couple of times. But this last time, it was just under 2 weeks prior. And so, yes, he had then started turning up, following her, posting about her. And, you know, she actually said to him at the gym when he turned up in that same room that she was working out on, you know, you've got to be kidding me. Why are you following me all the time? But previous girlfriends had said the same thing. Now, one of his ex-girlfriends, Alexandra Pell, she basically gave evidence, and she said that when she broke things off with him, he called her persistently and slashed her tires.
And that, I hope she reported that to the police. But it would have been my hope that having reported that to the police, the next police officer that was confronted by Molly and her mother would have pulled up that record and immediately gone out and arrested him, because this is obviously persistent behavior on his part, and
well,
it's
that's
dangerous.
What you'd expect, Jim. But you know, I can tell you from what I've learned about this case is that actually he was reported on 5 occasions, and there were at least two previous girlfriends. I suspect there were more than that. There was another girlfriend who said, or ex, that she was scared of him and that he stalked her too. But these were reported, and they were reported to Kent Police too. Now, there have been some critical issues, not just with Kent Police. Actually, these occur across all police forces. But Kent, I remember reviewing a case and actually writing a report for the murder of a woman called Natalie Ezak, another terrible case, who was stalked and murdered by her ex-partner, who was an ex-detective at Kent Police, who I will not mention his name. And we try not to on our podcast. She had split up with him 6 times, and every time she split up with him, he would then pursue her and become even more obsessed and fixated with her. And sadly, I ended up writing a report, which I'd rather be writing the risk assessment to keep her alive. And Kent Police have also had the Bluestone case and numerous others. And you would expect learning to have taken place. And I get very frustrated with these cases, and I call them murder in slow motion, because that's what they are. They are the most dangerous of cases, and yet little resources attributed to them. But it's not just Kent. There was Alice Ruggles in Northumbria, and at this very conference that we had held in London, Clive Ruggles at the same time was doing the keynote speech about his daughter Alice and explaining what happened to Alice. And the two cases are very similar. You know, a very polite, lovely, beautiful, intelligent woman starting out on her life post-university, and she gets mixed up with somebody who becomes obsessed and fixated with her. And the same lessons repeat, in that she wasn't taken seriously. There weren't checks conducted on him in terms of his history of offending behaviour. We keep having these reports called, you know, the lessons to be learned. And for me, 20 years on, we're still saying the same thing over and over and over again. And where does it stop? Where is there a stop point of just these lame reports with no real action? And yet the next family, you have to look in the whites of their eyes, which I did with Clive Ruggles, his wonderful wife, Sue, and the rest of the family. And, you know, they have such humility. They don't want to see another family go through what they have. But yet you're hearing the same things. And I'm just so frustrated with it when, you know, these same patterns repeat over and over and over again.
Right. And towards your point, Molly's ex learned that he could be fearless because he never paid for his previous behavior. And in fact, when The police called him in front of McLaren, and the police officer said, "We wouldn't want Molly to come to the police station again about you, would we?" And Stimson just says, "Wouldn't we?" I mean, he had absolutely no fear.
Doesn't fear the consequence. Well, why would he?
Why?
And this is the problem with offenders. You know, they get away with it, and guess what happens? They become emboldened. I mean, Jim, we know this very well. Emboldened, they become arrogant. They feel that they have the power and control, and they up the ante, they escalate their behavior, and they don't fear the consequence. Meanwhile, the victims just become more terrified and lose trust and confidence in the very system that's there to protect them.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly discourages victims from coming forward if, when they do, they're not believed, or they're brushed under the rug, or they're basically just set up so that the offender is more angry at them. It just really, it just underlines the lack of utility of sort of the order of protection kind of process that we have here in the United States, which is absolutely useless, because you get an order of protection and it doesn't actually protect anybody, because these people are obsessed and they will not stop. And even an order of protection seems to them like a challenge that they want to overcome.
This was a narcissistic individual who was evil and should be locked up for a very long time. And I think 26 years does reflect that fact.
I have to ask, though, in terms of this case, like that, the case that you just talked about the police officer who was locked up, hopefully, for what he did to his ex-girlfriend. I mean, what kind of sentence did he get?
Well, actually, it was a precedential case. I was asked to write a report by the senior investigating officer, having been into Kent Police and trained, I think it was over 200 officers that were in one of my training sessions. And sadly, Natalie Isaac's case happened a number of months later. And one of the audience was a DCI called Paul Fotheringham. And he was now a senior investigating officer on the murder team. And this was a case that he was sadly investigating. Now, I didn't know whether I could help the team when he asked, could I assist them? But I went and sat with the inquiry team, went through the detail of what happened and analysed the case. And I ended up writing a report that was very instructive for the way the case was prosecuted, and actually changed the way the case was constructed in terms of the prosecution, how witnesses were interviewed, and even the psychiatrists in terms of their reports and what they presented. And it resulted in the defendant being sentenced to 26 years before parole. Now, that's quite an unusual case. I mean, normally when we've seen cases of domestic violence homicide, you're talking about, you know, in the main, when we look back, you know, maybe 5 years,
oh,
8 years.
That's outrageous. That's ridiculous. But I do think it argues for, especially this cop, he's going to get out in 6 years then, right? It was 20 years ago that it happened?
No, that wasn't 20 years ago. I believe it was 2010 when Natalie was murdered in Kent. And because he was an ex-detective, the other thing why Paul asked me to look at the case was because he was very charismatic. He understood the system and he felt that the judge and the jury would blame Natalie, even in her death, that she would be put on trial. She left him six times. Now, why? What was different on this occasion that when she left him, it was finality. I listened to a lot of phone calls that was made that he had called her up. And some days, and one day in particular, I remember that he texted her 144 times and called her in excess of 10 times. You know, this was somebody who was clearly obsessive. But I remember listening to the phone call the very last day. It was a Saturday. She was at a wedding with her new partner. And the new partner had been recording all of the calls and had kept all of the text messages because the new partner knew that this guy was a risk and he knew that it was escalating. He was collecting evidence, which was quite unbelievable. But the last phone call, which was roughly an hour long, she had said to him very clearly, "I'm not going to come back to you. And I want you to get on with your life and I have to get on with mine." Now, she said it with no malice at all. But in that moment, he understood she was never coming back to him. Now, this is an important point because it talks to finality. The times before, the six times before, he used power and control tactics to manipulate her and get her back. This time he had tried everything and none of them worked. This time she had made it clear, "I'm staying with my new partner. I want you to move on with your life." And it's at that point, it was almost like I heard a gear shift in what he the way that he was processing it. And then he started to threaten her and say, "Tick tock, tick tock, you're a dead woman walking. And Jesus. I'm prepared to do time for this. I don't care what it takes. You're going to pay. You've taken everything from me." So he moved into the threat mode. But the difference with the threat mode, A, you could hear it in his voice and in his tone. But B, he was trying to establish where she was, her movements, her whereabouts, not for the Saturday, but for the Monday morning. He badgered her and badgered her. And in the end, you could hear the resignation in her voice when she said, "Yes, I'll be at the hairdressing salon on Monday." And with that, the phone went dead. Now, we did have CCTV footage that we looked at from the Monday where he had gone to buy a knife on the Monday morning. So you can hear the echoes back to Molly. Certainly for me, in this particular case, he's seen buying a knife. He goes to the hairdressing salon. You see him go to the hairdressing salon and look in through the window. He sees that she's there along with her young trainee that's there. He then goes in and he stabs her multiple times. He says, "You deserve this, bitch. You deserve everything you get." He threw the knife and then he went and paid the parking meter, got back in his car, drove home to his house and waited for the police to arrive. And by that time, he had concocted his self-defense, its loss of control, because there is a defense of loss of control in England and Wales, which is a major problem. And that's why I was asked to come in and look at this case in particular. But it really, the lessons there of victims not being believed, certainly of victims being fearful. I heard in Natalie's voice, and I dare say with Molly and other cases I've looked at, where victims are resigned to the fact that no one's going to protect them. And the perpetrators, this finality, you know, where they have nothing left to lose. And there's entitlement, there's last resort thinking, and the fact that they're serial predators and perpetrators. And when there's coercive control and stalking, you mix it with an attitude from the police when someone reports with, "Well, what do you want us to do about it?"
Well, in that case, what we want you to do is arrest him for threatening to kill her. Period. That's it. That you need nothing more. That is a crime that he should be locked up for. The fact is, he's dangerous, and he says he's willing to do time for it. But here's the thing. In cases like this, this guy is going to get out. He's going to be out free again. And I'm thinking we should be saying his name so women out there don't become his next victim. We should be warning the public about these people. They get such short sentences in the UK. I mean, even 26 years. He murdered her deliberately. First degree murder. He did it intentionally, knowing that he was going to go to jail for it. So that's not at all a deterrent for him. He's never going to stop being dangerous.
Yeah, that I couldn't agree more with you. And actually, it was he was sentenced to at least 28 years for murdering her in her hairdressing salon. And yes, he will come out. I mean, that's the minimum that he will serve before he's paroled. And as I mentioned, he is an ex-detective or was an ex-detective at Kent Police, actually within the police force. So perhaps we should be mentioning his name, which is Ivan Isaac. And our listeners can Google the case. There's a lot that was written about it and reported about it in the actual media at the time. And I have to say it echoes back to the murder of Holly Gazzard, who was also stalked and murdered in her hairdressing salon in Gloucestershire. And Rachel Williams, who was also stalked. She was shot by her ex-partner. Unfortunately, she survived. But that was also in a hairdressing salon. And so when victims are reporting, some of the most important information we have to find out is what's happening in terms of risk and where people are working, whether there's been a credible threat to kill. Each of these cases have a credible threat to kill in them. And when we're talking about credible, well, we know the research tells us that one in two of domestic violence stalkers. So when there's been an intimate relationship and it may be two dates, it might be 3 weeks, it might be 22 years. When there's been an intimate relationship, if that individual makes a threat, then one in two of them will actually carry out that threat.
Right. And that's enough to make it adamant that those threats are a crime that will be prosecuted and results in jail time.
But how long could they possibly be held? That's what I'm curious about. And when they're
threat of death.
Yeah.
I mean,
what would be the sentence for something?
Well,
like
I mean,
that?
In the UK, and I'll talk about England and Wales specifically, because we have an offence of stalking, and we also have an offence of coercive control, and we also have threats as well. Now, multiple charges can be laid at any one time, and what we're not seeing happen is, say, in the case of Molly or any of the cases that I've described, since the new laws coming in, so one was the stalking was 2012, coercive control was 2015, we're not seeing multiple charges being made. Now, stalking carries a maximum sentence of 10 years now. We campaigned for that. That came in last year. So those sentences are there if somebody is arrested for the crimes that are on the statute book. But right now, that's not what we're seeing.
And are they cumulative? Can you be sentenced to 10 years for stalking and 5 years for threatening and
you
5
can,
years
yes.
for doing something else?
You can. And that's so, how we wrote the coercive control law, that even though, you know, it mirrors the stalking law, that the Section 2A of stalking is 6 months maximum, but the Section 4A, the more serious, of putting someone in fear of violence or where there's serious alarm and distress that it impacts on your day-to-day activities, then that's a maximum of 10 years. So yes, you could have a number of offences being charged
right.
for, but that's
without
not happening.
Having touched anyone. And that's important. That's the kind of law that can save lives, as opposed to after the fact saying, oh yeah, we'll punish him because he got away with murdering this person who was asking for help, who knew she was in danger, and who went to the police. It's
right.
not like she was hiding it from them.
And that's the whole point of it. You know, previously with the harassment law, you know, people said, well, how do you know someone presents a threat, and how do you know that you're putting someone in fear of violence? And with the stalking law, you don't even have to have a threat, and you don't have to have a physical behaviour. But the problem is, right now, people don't see online behaviour that is risky. They don't even check social media. If victims are telling them, they don't take it seriously. Now, we've just covered the Florida shooting. Right. You know, we live our lives online and offline. And so I'm afraid police forces can no longer say that they didn't understand the cyber aspect. And of course, it's a huge growth area in terms of knowledge and education and raising awareness. But I am just saturated and just really had enough of keep seeing the same patterns repeating, and young girls and women losing their lives in similar circumstances, and yet the learning is not being promulgated. And to me, that comes down to leadership. That comes down to the leadership of chief officers, because it sits with them, that if they see this area of public protection as a priority, then they resource it. They will bring in Paladin and make sure that there's specialist-led training. If they don't see it as a priority, well, then guess what? They don't do anything about it. And yet we have young girls who are terrified, and women saying exactly what's happening online and offline. And we have somebody picking up a phone and making a call to the perpetrator as if it's just something that is very minor.
Yeah, that'll take care of it.
And it makes it worse, obviously. It aggravates the problem. So many of our listeners, I just can't even believe that so many of them have restraining orders against their ex-husbands and ex-boyfriends and such and such. And it doesn't seem to be doing any good. And in fact, is this true, Jim, that you have to put your address on the restraining order? So sometimes the stalker finds out where they are?
Yeah, because you can't be within X number of feet or yards of that location.
Right.
So it's ridiculous. What the restraining order should say is that if they come within this many feet, that they will be warned, they must leave immediately, and that's it. Because if they're in a church, if they're in a school, if they're in a mall, they could have a chance encounter. They should be warned, and they should have to leave, no matter what they're doing, no matter where they are. But instead, what happens is, you know, it lists the location they live or work or go to school or whatever. That just gives the offender more information about where they are.
Right.
Puts them at risk.
And this is where Paladin, you know, the ISACs, the Independent Stalking Advocacy caseworkers, who are trained and accredited to understand the criminal justice system as well as the civil justice system, they can help with writing all the different orders to make sure that they're worded in the right way, to make sure that we don't give other information to perpetrators. It's also where we need to see the register for serial perpetrators. because guess what? These people don't just operate in isolation. This isn't the first time that they do this. It's multiple times. Now, it's one thing it being in the same police force, but when it's across different police force areas or different regions, then that becomes even more of a challenge. So that's why we've been campaigning for the register for serial stalkers and domestic violence offenders, because they are the most dangerous. They are the most likely to carry out a physical attack and create serious harm and homicide. And we've also been campaigning for new orders that are like the sex offenders prevention orders that place a positive obligation on the perpetrator. Now, why that is important is that too often with restraining orders, it's the victims that are seen as being restrained and that they have to change their behaviour, i.e. Molly, well, don't go to the gym, well, don't go to the pub, well, don't go out. Well, before you know it, you've got somebody who's living their life in a box and they can't go anywhere or do anything. But guess what? It's not Molly or other victims. It's not their behaviour that should be being managed. It's the perpetrator.
So how do we manage the perpetrator without letting them know where the victim will be? Like, what do we do to keep that person, the one who's actually doing the offending behavior, in a box and away from the victim?
Yeah, well, there's two things. I mean, one, it might be it's about a geographic boundary that's placed around the victim, i.e. they're not allowed to enter wherever their key anchor points might be. But victims do tend to be fairly local in terms of, you know, where you go to work, where you socialise, where you live. And so it could be that it's about the buffer zone. And we don't always have to put addresses in the same as names of people that the stalker isn't allowed to contact, because of course you don't want them having that information. It could be about tagging offenders so that they operate on a sort of a reverse geographic boundary, so that they're the ones that, and police are notified if they come into a particular area.
Or the offender has an ankle bracelet on and the victim's phone will beep if that person comes anywhere near them. And all they have to do is hit a button and it informs 911 and the guy gets
That's a great idea.
Right. I mean, it's very simple things that we've recommended. And, you know, again, for government to take these things seriously. But I still feel that, you know, having a register so that we track and identify those individuals, but also have orders that place positive obligations on the perpetrator, i.e. that they cannot do certain things. So a sex offender, for example, if they are predatory towards young children, then they're not allowed to go near schools. There's certain places that there are exclusion zones. So why can't we do the same?
Exactly. You
for
give up
all
the
perpetrators?
Right to go to public places if you're having this kind of offending behavior or obsessive behavior. If you're stalking someone, you should be restricted to your home, not the victims.
And it's complete common sense. You know, we do it with sex offenders, but yet stalkers and domestic violence offenders are just allowed to do and act with impunity. And that's why victims become mistrustful and distrustful of the criminal justice system. And again, police and others get frustrated with victims when they're terrified and they're being manipulated by perpetrators and they're trying to survive and stay alive when they're not doing the things that police are telling them to do. But actually, we should be focusing solely on the perpetrator, on their behavior, tracking them. And if the behavior doesn't get them what they want, well, guess what? They just stop doing that behavior. And so you start to micromanage them down, you restrict them, and it works. It's not rocket science. And with some of these individuals, you have to put them psychosocially at the center of the change behavior. And that's the only time they might become invested in it. But stalkers do stalk for different reasons. But the ones we've been talking about today primarily are the rejected, the revengeful, you know, and resentful, those who are entitled, those who are trying to make the victim pay, or they're trying to take control, because if I can't have you, then no one can. Mm-hmm. And so the psychology of it is important to understand when we're thinking about risk assessment and risk management. But, you know, my heart goes out to Molly's family. Yeah. Yes. Just absolutely devastating for them. And the fact that they were terrified and they went to the very place that they thought would help them, the police, and they literally listed off the high risk factors. And they literally listed off the high risk factors, and yet it appears that the police weren't trained and they could have done some very simple things. Now, it's not saying that in every case that would keep someone safe, but you've got to ask the right questions about what's happening. You've got to be trained to understand what those questions mean. That's why I've spent 20 years working with other experts and professionals, creating these tools like the Dash, the S Dash, creating tools as well as best practice that we've rolled out through Paladin and training staff, getting into training sessions with them. It's the best investment of their time so that we make sure that the next Molly that walks in isn't fobbed off, isn't placed at more harm or in more danger because of the action that somebody takes, maybe unwittingly, unconsciously, but it still places a victim in even more danger. And we want to make sure that that doesn't happen.
The verdict has brought us a small measure of comfort, but it seems that nothing will take away the pain or allow us to come to terms with our Molly being taken from us. We are serving a lifetime of pain, anguish, and loss.
Thank you.
One thing in the United States is that we do have laws that if police officers respond to a domestic violence or domestic complaint, they have to do something. If there is an allegation, they have to bring the offending party in. They can't just go home, because we've seen in our studies that doing that, just leaving the parties together, ends up in greater violence and death. So it is important that here, at least, we have seen an increase in the level of attention and severity that police attach to domestic violence situations. However, with stalking, it just hasn't happened here in the U.S. yet. Stalkers are free to go and do whatever they want to do unless and until they actually put a hand on somebody. And usually, that's when they kill them. Yeah. That's when it's too far, too long gone. They are too over the edge. And at that point, it doesn't protect the victims. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm not convinced the U.S. has got a handle on domestic abuse, actually.
Not a handle at all,
Jim. I mean, yeah. 3 women are murdered every day at the hands of their ex-partner here.
Yeah.
Every day. Now, that tells me the majority of them are probably going to be stalking cases, but because they are power and control offences, and that somebody then becomes obsessed on separation and fixated. But 3 every day here, 2 women every week in the UK. I mean, neither countries and many others across the world have not got a handle on it because they don't see domestic abuse or stalking as serious issues. They just see them as misdemeanors or hysterical women reporting silly things that may be something or nothing. You know, someone turning up or so what, they sent you a post on Facebook. You know, that tends to be sort of the general attitude. Just don't go on Facebook. Just don't read it. Don't go on Twitter. Don't go on Instagram. That's the kind of thing that are still being said in both spaces, in the UK and the US, because I'm hearing about them every day. So it's an attitude and an aptitude problem. It's an awareness raising issue. And that's why we feel strongly, of course, about talking about it on Real Crime Profile, raising awareness. It's letting people know about risk tools that are out there, that if you're a dad or a brother or a sister or a best friend, research it. Go on the Dash risk checklist website. Have a look at the tools that are available. Ask those questions of what's happening to your loved one, and take that in when you report it to the police with Laura Richards' compliments, because it's important that you help those who are not trained understand the best practice tools that exist. And most people, I have to say, in the police and law enforcement are well-intended and well-intentioned. But like I said, these are the most dangerous cases. And if they're not trained, they don't understand what they're seeing. And we need to give them a lens as specialists to help them understand the risks that are posed. Because these are, I'll say it again, the most dangerous of cases unchecked.
I'm sorry, I'm looking at a letter right in front of me from a friend who's worried about another friend. She can't get a restraining order because he hasn't hurt her yet. You know, and this is what they're up against. And I know that, you know, hopefully in the future the laws will change, but right now they're not changing. So I'm so worried about what our listeners can do to protect themselves, and they need professional help, because obviously the police are not always going to be able to help them. So they should find an organization like Paladin locally. And that's, you know, we can't obviously give specific advice to every listener who writes to us. I do try to help direct them to groups who can get them into a safe situation and have a plan, but you need to get professional help outside of the police, it seems.
You do, and that's why the advocates are so important. I mean, having set up Paladin in the UK, we're still talking about US, and this is something I'd like to see as a global service in all parts of the world. They're specialist advocates, they're university accredited, and so they understand every aspect of the law, but also the civil justice options, and can problem solve the case, working with the police to help them and coordinate the response. So it is a highly specialist area. What I would also say is that domestic violence advocates and domestic violence charities aren't always trained in stalking. So they don't always understand that these are the most dangerous of cases. They don't understand that 75% of the murders happen on separation and that 34% of them happen in the first month. So that happening in the first month, there's a window of time. You know, I always say it's the first month to the fourth when we need to focus much more effort and energy and attention working with victims, rather than this, the old adage being said, of, well, if only they would leave. You know, if they left the situation, then it would stop. Well, actually, no. At the point of separation, that's when it escalates and it can get worse. So that training for domestic violence charities and professionals across all professions, as well as mums and dads, you know, just getting somebody out of a situation doesn't make them safe on its own. You have to put the support, the advice, you know, put a proper safety plan together to ensure that we keep somebody alive, as well as their children. So it does cut across child protection as well.
And something to notice about Molly's killer is that he does not look like a monster. You know, he looks charming.
They never do,
attractive.
Lisa. That's
no,
the
I know.
Thing.
That's the thing. And we try to do this on Criminal Minds, is not always cast somebody who looks like they're capable of violence. And I've just been watching the footage of after he murders Molly. He just stands there covered in her blood. There's just footage of him just walking very calmly towards the police. It's absolutely chilling. He's not.
He did what he intended to do. This was a premeditated act. And make no mistake about that. Somebody who is warned by the police on the 27th and then goes out and buys at least one knife and a pickaxe. And then he tracks her down and goes to the gym on the 29th that he knows that she's a member of. He had murder in mind. And so his claim of diminished responsibility is just absurd and outrageous. This was absolutely about control and rejection and taking revenge. And he went there to perform a particular task, and that task was murder. Thank goodness the judge and jury disagreed with what his defence team were saying, and they agreed that it was premeditated, and he was sentenced to 26 years before parole. Still, no real sentence, I would say, you know, in terms of the family. You know, life is not life in the UK. Life is 15 years, but of course, if for good behaviour, it can then be 7 years. But we are seeing now, I know lots of people also reacted to the case of War Boys, which was the taxi driver in London. We call them black cab drivers. This case was in the press a number of times. Firstly, because this was somebody who had raped many women, and now it's believed to be in excess of over 200 women.
Oh,
mm-hmm. And instead of charging him and prosecuting him for all of those cases, it was then deemed at that time for the Director of Public Prosecutions, Keir Starmer, that they would only charge him with 12.
Right. It really, Laura, it makes no sense. I mean, then there's 188 victims who are not addressed, at least. And the fact is that because of the low sentencing guidelines in the UK, that guy is eligible to get out shortly.
Right.
And he's a repeat offender who has victimized hundreds of women. He should never get out again. Why did they not just keep prosecuting for the other cases until they got enough sentence to put him away forever?
Well, that's a good question, Jim, and it's one that everybody's asking. You know, it's certainly now had a very serious impact because he is due to be released. And in fact, there's been a lot of challenge about the fact the parole board have said that he will be paroled, that now there's a judicial review to get to how that decision was made. that he can be paroled, and how is the decision made that he's deemed not to be a risk to the public? You know, what has actually happened in that decision making? And the two women who were recently in court for, it was actually at the Supreme Court, which is our highest court in the UK, they challenged the Metropolitan Police on this particular case because they were two of 100 plus victims. But they're also challenging, and it's called a judicial review, why and how that decision has been made. And the Met lost their appeal.
Is there a way to resentence him? And if not, is the statute of limitations, has it already run on the other rapes?
Well, he could be resentenced. I mean, firstly, it was the Met lost the landmark appeal that they had. They were challenging the fact that two of his victims had received compensation. And they were challenging that. The victims were saying it was the Article 3, their right not to be subjected to torture or degrading treatment. And so this is a landmark ruling, but I'll come back to that. So, yes, the fact that he's served his time for those 12 rapes, well, that's one issue. But the other issue is, what about all the other victims? Could he be arrested and charged for those other cases? I believe that he can be. And so, you know, how it's being determined, what they're really trying to get to is the nub of how has it been determined that he is no longer a risk. What did they base that decision on? I mean, there's some very interesting narratives just online that people can read. It certainly is a very significant decision that the Met lost the landmark appeal, because what it means is that potentially more victims of crime may come forward to sue the police for failures in their investigations. So, for example, the case like Molly, you know, it comes down to what's deemed to be serious, because it's for cases that are deemed to be serious, but it opens that door. And it's interesting that for a long time, I've certainly seen cases where Article 2 cases have tried to be brought. That's the right to life, by victims and lawyers and charities standing side by side. And those cases have always failed.
Right.
This is the first time where the police will come under scrutiny in cases of that are deemed to be serious, and it's deemed that the police have not taken the effective action that they should have. And the Supreme Court judge, Lord Kerr, clarified it by saying, it's important to make the point that if the investigation is seriously defective, even if no systemic failures are present, this will be enough to render the police liable. So it's not just about all cases, it's about particular cases where they're serious. And War Boys, I mean, this really is going to be the test in this case. Peter Fahey, who is the Chief Constable of Greater Manchester Police, actually weighed in and said this is a disaster for the police. There are just going to be lots of cases that are being brought. But I think the Supreme Court Justice Lord Kerr has clarified it. And interestingly, Peter Fahey, who is, as I said, the ex-chief of Greater Manchester Police, well, under his watch, Sabina Akhtar was stalked and murdered, Katie Boardman, Claire Wood. There was case after case after case. And Independent Police Complaints Commissions investigated many cases. I remember 9 of them all in a row. And in fact, Refuge, which is a big charity, and Helena Kennedy, a baroness, and QC tried to challenge Greater Manchester Police under Article 2 in the Sabina Akhtar case, and they failed. So it's interesting that he's weighed in on this. But I think that this is something that's been a long time coming, actually. And I am really pleased that, and I absolutely pay tribute to the two victims who have brought this case. And they were not mentioning their names intentionally, because they haven't waived their right to anonymity.
This brings up a really good point. And if you hurt them in their pocketbook, that it will cause change. What this landmark case has done, it made the police financially liable for not actually following protocol and protecting victims. So in the future, they know they must put in place procedures that will prevent that from happening, because it's going to cost them. It's the same as what's happening right now in the public. So many major corporations are pulling away their support for the NRA because of the shooting in Florida and the ones that preceded it. So many corporations have realized that the public is sick of this and something has to be done.
The NRA is a very powerful organization with millions and millions of dollars to spend to influence politicians and society. Now, that is going to stop because major corporations realize that their affiliation with the NRA is going to cost them money. If you hurt somebody in their pocketbook, you can change behavior. It's what happened in South Africa. It's how apartheid was destroyed. We need to think of that in every way, shape, and form when we need to shape public policy. And in this case, for stalking, for sexual harassment, for violence in the home, for domestic abuse, all those things, we need to hurt the agencies in the pocketbook if they're not doing their jobs, if they're not protecting the victims.
Right. And that's all that's being asked of the police is do your job. If it's a priority, then it gets done. Police leadership, if public protection, if women and girls being murdered and stalked and abused is a priority for you, then you will train your staff the same as you do with counterterrorism. But yet that hasn't happened repeatedly. And, you know, with the Me Too movement, everyone is fed up of seeing, and I'm one of them, the same lessons, the same things happening over and over and over again. And what's interesting about this landmark ruling, which happened on the 21st of February, is that the victims DSD and NBV, that's the acronyms or the letters that are being used, they went to the High Court in 2013 because of the failures of the investigation. And the Met did not accept this 4 years ago. So this was their appeal about that. They didn't accept that they had failed the victims. And so they took the case to the Supreme Court. They used taxpayers' money to defend and basically try and get that overturned. And so they took the victims to the highest court in the land. So the money that was spent, you know, is taxpayers' money fighting these victims.
Oh, fighting them. Okay.
Yeah, fighting the original decision. Now, these were two victims, as I mentioned. I mean, we know with serial perpetrators in particular, whatever we see is just a tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. You know, some speculate 200. I'd probably say if this guy has been using a black cab and, is, you know, he was married and the things that his ex-partner said about him, you're probably talking hundreds of victims, not just 105 or 200. You know, there'd be many out there that have never come forward. And so this is somebody who's incredibly prolific, hence why we need the register. And I agree, if you hit people in where it hurts, which tends to be the money trail, then it's very effective at changing behaviour. And nothing else as yet has been effective. A murder happens. I've tended to be called in, as well as other experts, to deliver training. And you do these one-off hits of training and they tick the box that, yes, there's been a review of what we did or didn't do, but now we've changed. We've had one person come in and deliver training, tick, nothing to see here. Everyone moves on until the next case happens. And for me, that's been the 20-year cycle, and I've had enough of it, quite frankly. Yeah. So I think there are some victories here. They may be small, but there are some good things that are happening, along with sentencing guidelines coming in for domestic violence, which were finally published on February the 22nd. I mean, it's taken decades to get sentencing guidelines for domestic violence. And I'm pleased, having campaigned for the sentencing guidelines for coercive control and stalking, they're going to be published in the summer of this year. And you might think it's crazy that you campaign for a new offence of stalking and coercive control. The offence comes in, but there's no sentencing guidelines to accompany them.
I know. And what I was going to say earlier was that when we're talking about the police agencies, that we just are asking them to do their jobs. Before they can do their jobs, the legislators have to give them the money for research and training and make sure that there are standards placed across all police agencies so that they all have the same level of proficiency and can help these victims when they walk through their doors or call 911 or 999.
Absolutely. I mean, challenging the legislative framework's been an important part, and making sure that the legislation works. And again, we continue to scrutinise how the new laws work, but also closing loopholes and gaps going forward. But the training for police forces, as well as for Crown prosecutors, you know, there are lots of professions who and professionals who do need training. And again, I would direct you to the Dash website, also to the Paladin website. And in the UK, there's great tools on Safe Lives' website as well. There's some real gold standards, great charities out there who work with victims. And we certainly have more work to do, campaigning for the register, which I've been told that although we've been pushing hard, we've got about 140,000 people who've signed the petition now. I did have a conversation with the Home Office saying that there's a consultation now coming out that will probably be published in March time. I wasn't really meant to say anything about that, but I'm going to.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, why not?
And what is a consultation for those who don't?
So it basically means that the government are taking soundings. So when Theresa May, you know, Prime Minister, came out and said that the domestic violence bill, I'm going to have this new bill that's going to change the landscape for victims of domestic violence, and this is going to be my swan song. Well, now there's been a few steps back to say, hang on, we're going to actually put a consultation out and ask people what they think. Now, for me, it's concerning because whilst this is happening and everyone's still talking about it, some of us as experts have been in this sector for 20 plus years. We know what needs to change. So why not listen to what we've been saying for the last 20 years and get the bloody register in and the things that we know needs to come in rather than having another paper exercise that's going to take months? And the fact is, women are still dying. Just today, I looked on a news link that was sent to me of a woman who was killed. She was pushed out of a speeding car by probably her partner, ex-partner, on the M20, and was dead. She was murdered, and he has been arrested. Now, whilst all this talk is happening, and for me, talk is cheap, girls and women like Molly are being murdered, and I just wish government would listen to the right people and ensure that evidence-based good practice is used and the right things are put into this bill. Now, they've told me that it's not going to talk to a register as such. They've put in there about seriality. I don't even know if that's a word, but that's what they called it, which is about serial perpetrators. And we've already researched it. We've already spoken to police forces. We already know what people think. And overwhelmingly, 140,000 people think that a register like the Violent and Sexual Offenders Register, which already exists, VISA, should be used. So why aren't we using it? It's common sense. It saves lives. It saves money. So the short answer to your question, Lisa, is probably that it's a paper exercise that will go out for consultation. People will see certain things written in it of options. Everybody then gets a chance to respond, from specialists to other professionals to victims, families. Everyone can consult on it. And then they will look at those soundings and probably still to decide to do whatever it was that they wanted to do.
Right, in the first place, yeah.
Yeah, so again, it's months. It's going to take months, rather than her saying that this was something she takes very seriously and therefore it's going to happen relatively quickly. But that's where we're at. So I wouldn't surprise me if they put it out on International Women's Day as their kind of, yes, these things are happening, but this is what we're doing about it, you know, with a view to maybe November 25th, when it's White Ribbon International Violence Against Women and Girls Day and Week, that they make an announcement then. But it could be even longer than that. But I just hope they have heard Zoe Dromfield, John Clough, Nick Gazzard, Holly Gazzard's father, Clive Ruggles, who's Alice Ruggles' father, and Sue, all of us who say that the register is required.
Our hearts certainly go out to Molly McLaren's family and all the other Molly McLarens out there and their families. And we hope that this discussion in the public will help embolden people to come forward and to make noise and to force the legislators and the police to protect the victims. This is their job. This is why most police officers actually became law enforcement professionals, to help people, give them the tools, make sure they're trained on them, and then actually use the tools to protect victims and prevent terrible, horrific crimes like this from being committed.
And as you know, if you are a police officer, you know, I certainly know through my years of working at New Scotland Yard, so many people want to work major crime and want to work murders when, you know, the victim is already dead, sadly, and 80% of crime is solved by forensics. You know, I'd just like you to think about the fact that the most challenging work is keeping people alive. That's where you can make the biggest difference. You can be a lifeline to somebody and keep them alive. And so, you know, please just consider the public protection aspect and using the right tools, the decision logs like Dash. You know, these are the cases where they are the most dangerous when people reach out, and when they're not believed, it puts them further at risk. And, you know, for me, this has been a very charged episode, and you can probably tell, you know, it's my 20 years of frustration coming out of looking people in the whites of the eyes, families who have lost their loved ones, and hearing the same things and witnessing how amazing it is in the same breath as something so devastating and catastrophic happening to them, how much humility they show of wanting to change things so that somebody else's family doesn't go through what they have. I mean, I just don't know how they do that. But I, in particular, wanted to dedicate this episode to Molly, hashtag her name was Molly, and to her family and friends and those around them to support them. And I really still want to be part of the charge, trying to make those changes and ensure that people understand the risks, and that we don't have this standing figure of two women every week being murdered. I want to see that change. And to our listeners, if you're police, if you're prosecutors, if you're a mother, a father, you too can make a difference. And we need to, as non-abusers, challenge those abusers, the serial perpetrators who get away with it. Because if we're all together and we close down their behaviour, we are the majority and we can make those changes. But if we stay silent, if we don't challenge them, if we don't make them change their behaviour, then they're going to continue doing what they're doing and getting away with it.
Yeah. Well said. Well said, Laura. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.